Hello, my name's Tony Stimson. I'm president of the South Australian Boer War Association, and I'm here today to speak about my interest in South Australian involvement in the Anglo-Boer War and the war generally.
Tony, let's talk about your background to start off with. I understand that you are a founder of Ainsbury College. Could you just tell us a little bit about that?
Well, that's a story in itself. I think that the whole idea of three of us founding a school without a cent in government funding and run it without any government funding for 7 years, would be unthinkable now, but we managed to do it. And Ainsbury was a specialist years 11 and 12 school, still is, with year 10 now. And it filled a significant niche in the market, and three of us saw that there was an opportunity there. We'd been chief examiners in different year 12 subjects, and I had been in history. And there was an opportunity there and a need for a school like this. And I think the school's left it punched above its weight over the last 20-odd years of its existence.
Were you there until you retired?
I was. I stepped down as principal in 2007 because I thought it's time for the school to have another leader and time for me to do some other things.
Well, amongst those other things was you expanded on your interest in the Boer War. Tell us why you had this interest in the Boer War.
Well, my PhD was in history, but that was a long time ago, and it was on nothing as interesting as the Boer War. I became interested in this because my grandfather, Captain Alfred Norton, who died nearly 30 years before I was born, he'd served in the 4th South Australian contingent as a captain, came back with a Distinguished Service Order. I knew very little about him because very little survived in the way of family records, some photographs, yes, but not much else. And I thought, this is something, not having used my history skills for such a long time, I really want to get into. And so it began out of the interest in finding out more about my grandfather's life, even though he's dead in 1922, and reconstructing a life that I didn't know. And gradually it evolved into finding out more about South Australian involvement in this war and the war generally, and in particular writing a history of my grandfather's unit, the 4th South Australian Imperial Bushmen, which will appear late this year or early next year.
Did you have many personal mementos and records, diaries, letters, etc. from your grandfather?
Sadly, no. There's only one letter surviving, which he wrote to my grandmother. It's a one-page letter written in pencil. They nearly all were, for the obvious reason you can't cut inkwells around the veldt. So they wrote on the back of saddles, the back of biscuit boxes, anywhere they could find the time to write, any hard surface, and a pencil on a pencil sharpener, and any bit of paper they could loot from a captured Boer store or whatever else. But that literally is the only thing, apart from a Boer Bible. British officers, and I'm counting my grandfather as a British officers helped themselves regularly to Boer Bibles. Call it looting, call it souveniring. They had a word, which I think is a curious word, commandeering. But most Australians came home with something from the Boer War. This particular Bible is a beautiful piece. It's a small pocket Bible with the name P.R. De Wet, which is a historic Boer name. Three P.R. De Wets fighting for the Boers in the war, and one is General P.R. De Wet. Is it his Bible that my grandfather brought home with him that now sits on my desk? I don't know, and I've no way of really finding out.
Wow, that's amazing. Can you tell us a little bit about the background to the Boer War, and then we'll go on to your grandfather's service?
Okay, the war in South Africa, which goes by various names, because it's sometimes known as the Boer War in Australia. I use the term Anglo-Boer War because it does take two to fight a war. If we were starting again, we'd call it the South African War, because increasingly there's a recognition that a lot of black people were involved in this war, and that it's not just a war between the two white tribes, the Dutch Boers and the British. The causes of the war are complex. The conventional interpretation is that the British, egged on by Cecil Rhodes, who had founded Rhodesia, named it after himself, and Sir Alfred Milner, were concerned to incorporate these two largely Dutch-speaking republics, the South African Republic, or Transvaal, and the Orange Free State into the British Empire. That's the conventional interpretation, which has generally been held to be true. I think there's an argument that the Boer republics were a lot more aggressive than that, in fact, suggests, and President Kruger of the South African Republic clearly had visions of a South Africa in which the British were knocked out of South Africa and in which all of South Africa would be under Dutch or Boer rule. So the immediate trigger, the discovery of gold in Johannesburg, the richest reef of gold in the world by a long way. And in the 1890s, a lot of Europeans poured into Johannesburg to mine this new reef of gold. many Australians amongst them. And of course, because the Boers were small in number, they were not going to give these new English-speaking settlers the vote under any circumstances. So the ostensible fig leaf for the British to get involved and incorporate these two republics into the British Empire was that the Boer government of President Kruger in the Transvaal was denying the basic suffrage which British males had a right to expect, was denying them that. It's a bit more complicated than that, but that's essentially, in a nutshell, the story of how the war begins. Technically, the Boers begin it by invading British Natal, but it's more complicated than that.
It always is, isn't it?
It is.
So when did Australia first become involved? When did our troops first arrive there?
Well, very quickly. The war starts in 1899, and even before it's begun, there are strong signs it's about to erupt. Queensland and other colonies very, very quickly offer troops. Now, at first, the British government wasn't terribly keen on this, but if you have these loyal colonials putting up their hands saying, me too, we want to help, the British generals thought they simply wouldn't need these colonials who knew nothing about soldiering. But the war starts in October 1899, and in December, the British suffer three massive defeats in three completely different parts of South Africa. Not for nothing does the British press call this Black Week. And it's with Black Week that the British government suddenly accepts that these Boer farmers, who do not wear uniforms, they don't have a regular army, they despise the term soldiers, they think of themselves as citizens, burghers, defending their two republics. And they loathe the word soldier because of the element of compulsion in it. The Boers, not having a regular army, their idea of discipline in their army is completely different. Early in the war in particular, if you disagreed with what your particular commando was proposing to do, the plan of action, you could say, no, I disagree, I'm sitting this out. Try that in any other army except the Boers. If you had 100 Boers, you had 100 generals, effectively. So the war gets underway. The Boers are swiftly mounted on little ponies. British infantry in this huge theatre of war, because South Africa's bigger than we often forget. British infantry finds it very quick to respond. And so after Black Week in December 1899, increasingly the British government and the generals on the spot think we do need these colonials, because these colonials supposedly can ride like the Boers. We mount them on horses, we use them as mounted infantry. They're not fighting from horseback, so they're not cavalry fighting with sabre. The horse is simply a means of locomotion, getting around a very big country and fighting the Boers at their own game. And so whereas the British government initially was, if you like, cynical about the importance of taking the colonials on, and really only did so for political reasons early, I think, by early 1900 there's a real recognition that these colonial troops, Canadians too, New Zealand Rough Riders, can play a really useful role because of their experience with horses and shooting, in a way that perhaps most ordinary, the products of Britain's slums, as infantry, just didn't have. So increasingly it becomes a mounted war as infantry units in South Africa are converted to mounted infantry. And it's a war which just takes to play. Increasingly there are fewer and fewer battles and more skirmishes on isolated farms all over Orange Free State and all over Transvaal. So it's not a war of big pitch battles after late 1899. It's a war of skirmishes on this farm and that farm. And there was no front line. It's not like 1916 in the Somme, where you have hundreds of thousands of men packed shoulder to shoulder from the Swiss border to the North Sea. Rather, it's fewer men scattered over a big area, and you could never sure whether the shot that would get you would come from behind that hill or that one. But no obvious front line with the enemy over there and our boys over here, as you do have 15, 16 years later on the Western Front.
Sort of a guerrilla war.
Yes, the Boers didn't like that term, but it's a term we often use, and I think an appropriate one. The Boers were skilled horsemen. They had the advantage guerrillas often have, namely their wives and their children were still on their farms. Christian de Wet, perhaps the most famous of these Boer generals, guerrilla commanders, tough little man, wiry as anything, not above beating his own men with a leather whip. But de Wet believed, he used to say that his intelligence network from these women and children on the farms was such that he knew what every British soldier was doing within 70 miles of him every day.
Wow.
And this is one of the reasons, of course, why Lord Kitchener, the incoming British commander-in-chief, takes the very ruthless policy of clearing the farms, burning them down. The Australians initially hated doing this. And you take a man like Captain Howard Wilson, who was commander of A Squadron in the 4th Bushmen, a Mount Gambier man, devout Christian. He found this appallingly hard to do. Arriving at a farm, saying to the woman, who could barely speak English anyway, right, madam, you have 15 minutes. Get what you can out of your farm, and then I have to torch it. But that's early on, and I think the longer the war went on, and the more it became evident that the Boers were going to lose, but persistently did not give up, believing that a rabbit would turn out of a hat and they would still win, as they did believe, many of them did believe, the bitter enders, as they were called, the men who wanted to fight to the bitter end. The longer that happened, the more the Australians and the New Zealanders and the British burnt farmhouses to the ground without compunction, because they're bringing it on themselves. That's the way they increasingly saw it. They're going to lose this war. They haven't got a chance. They're up against the might of the British Empire. The total Boer population of these two small republics, the Transvaal and the Orange Free State, the total population was 270,000. And that's men of fighting age, old men, women, children. So the Boers could never put more than maybe 40,000 men in the field. And by 1901, late 1901, there are 450,000 British troops in South Africa. They're going to lose. And the fact that they don't give in, it irritated the Australians and the British troops increasingly. And I think they became a lot less sympathetic and burnt farmhouses to the ground. The reason for doing that, of course, was to get the women and children off the farms, destroy the Boers' intelligence network, and would mean that these classic Boer commandos, as they were called — the term commando is a Boer term, which Winston Churchill appropriated in World War II for another purpose — the Boer commandos increasingly didn't have access to that intelligence network, and they didn't have access to food supplies buried on their farms. So it's a complicated war, but it becomes increasingly nasty the longer it goes on, but not as nasty as World War One.
I could never understand why Lord Kitchener wasn't punished for his involvement in the first internment camps.
Well, the term — this is where the term concentration camp comes in. But of course, it's such a loaded term these days. When we think of it today, we think of Auschwitz and Belsen and 1945 and the horrors that were unveiled when Germany was occupied at the end of the war. But the term is actually invented by the British in 1900 because they felt a Christian obligation. If you're burning these farmhouses to the ground to destroy the Boers' access to their food supplies and their intelligence network of women and children, then you have a Christian obligation to do something for these women and children. You just can't leave them out there. The high veld of South Africa is extraordinarily high. Where the South Australians were fighting was mostly 4,000 to 5,000 feet above sea level. Now you try that in winter. Mount Lofty is less than half that height. And the Mount Lofty boys in our units froze like everybody else. It was just so high. So if you're burning their farmhouses, you felt that they really genuinely felt a Christian obligation. So they concentrated these groups of women and children at points along the railway line. And that's where the term concentration camp comes from. There are no gas chambers. There's nothing like that. But there was a terrible death toll. And the death toll came from measles. And the death toll came from enteric fever or typhoid. But there was nothing peculiar to the Boers. The British Army had been decimated by typhoid in the first part of the war. Sanitary generals just were not good at sanitary conditions. And Boer farm, Boer house, Boer women were not terribly good at that either. They hadn't been exposed to these sorts of things before. So the death toll in these camps — and remember how I said that the total Boer population of these two republics was 270,000. 27,000 die in these camps. That's one in every 10 in the whole Boer population. That tells you a lot about why there's such bitterness going right through almost to the present day between Boer and English-speaking Afrikaners. One in every 10 Boers dies in these camps, but not through extermination. When these camps, when the German camps were liberated in 1945, some people drew parallels between the British camps and the Australian and the Boer War, 1900, 1901 too, and the German camps. And that really upset many of the Australians who had served in these British camps. And Lieutenant Samuel White, for example, who was a distinguished South Australian, heavily involved in exploration, founder of Boy Scouts in South Australia, he wrote ferocious letters to the paper in 1945 saying, this is just a foul calumny. We gave the women and Boer women and children had the first tent, the first and the best tents before my own men did. We gave them as much food supplies as we had or more. But the whole term concentration camp became a very political one, of course. It's the nastiest unresolved aspect of the war after all this time still.
Yeah, terrible times, absolutely terrible times. Were the Australian troops all volunteers or were they conscripts?
Interesting, they're all volunteers. And you may well ask the question, had these Boer republics threatened Australia? No. So why did they volunteer? Well, they volunteer for a package of reasons. Now, my grandfather's unit, 230 men. I think if you unpacked those 230 men, you'd find 230 different sets of reasons for enlisting. If you take my grandfather now, he was a captain. He commanded a battery in the field artillery of the South Australian Armed Forces. Because we had our own armed forces before Federation. We had our own navy. We had a gunboat, the Protector, that sat in the Port River and operated at weekends. You had to be kind enough to hope that the invader would come at weekends. I think for South Australian Army officers like my grandfather, it was a real attraction to fight in a real war. I think the idea of military experience was something. So for officers in the South Australian Armed Forces, that was a major factor. Plus also, they were probably more likely to be middle class in background, and imperial loyalties to Queen and Empire, particularly after the British disasters of Black Week, 1899. I think that changed a lot of people who increasingly felt that, gosh, the Empire is in trouble and the colonies, you know, the mother cubs, need to rally around the mother country. And that was not just the case. He was in Canada too and in New Zealand. So I think imperial loyalties is one factor. But if you look at working class boys like Jack McBean, you know, Jack's 14, ran away from home, went to Western Australia where he had a half-sister, worked in some mines, tried to claim when he was back in Adelaide that he spoke Afrikaans or Dutch. He'd picked up a few swear words or expletives from miners who'd been to South Africa working on the nickel fields, and he tried to bluff his way in. He got there eventually to South Africa and never came home. Had two wives, two families that met for the first time at his funeral in 1964. So for a working class lad like Jack, I think that the main factor was economics, because we should never forget that the 1890s was the period of the 1890s Depression. And if you spoke about the Depression to anybody before 1930, the Depression was the 1890s Depression. It's one of the two great bookend depressions in Australian history. And that terrible depression was followed immediately by the Great Federation Drought, probably one of the two worst droughts we've ever had. So you had essentially misery in the cities, misery in the country. Economics, a job, taking the Queen's shilling, were no doubt a big factor. But then you've got a whole raft of other personal reasons. I found one man, Albert Wyman, who had tried to suicide twice in the 2 years before the war. His wife was involved with someone else. He tried to kill himself twice. Self-murder, as it was called, was a crime. I suspect he strongly that he went to South Africa to find a new life for himself. Quite a lot went to South Africa not intending to come home. I mean, Sergeant Keckwick, who was 37, an older man, public servant. He was a bachelor, loved cricket. He hoped to take his discharge in Cape Town, and then he was halfway to Lord's Cricket Ground, wasn't he? So he could see test matches in London and so on. So they had their so many different reasons for going, and patriotism and love of Empire and Queen, I think that was not necessarily the biggest one. The biggest single factor, without question, is adventure. Because it's not like the period since Vietnam, when during the Vietnam War, for people like us, all of a sudden television brought war into our houses every night on the 6 o'clock news. This is not like that in South Africa. You get this boy's own annual version of what's going on in South Africa. And it was romantic and it was a long way away, and so many men put their hand up because they had nothing better to do or because it was fun.
Was that the case with your grandfather?
No, I suspect, I don't have anything from him in writing about this, but I suspect being a middle-class man from a serving military background, I have no doubt at all that he really wanted to experience real war. Because remember that the South Australian military forces, they're part-time soldiers. Their one big activity every year was there at Easter, when they held their Easter camp on Mr. Everard's paddock down Anzac Highway. Well, it wasn't called Anzac Highway then, was it? And that must be where the suburb of Everard Park now is. And there they had a huge camp, and they would deploy and hold mock exercises, and they'd throw an imaginary invader into the sea down along West Beach and so on. So, but it's not the same thing as the real thing, the real chance to fight in a real war. And I suspect for men like my grandfather, that was the big driver in persuading him to go. No matter what my grandmother thought.
Were they married at the time?
They were married. They'd been married since 1895. They had three children. And what she thought about it, who knows? No one knows. And she was dead before I was born too. So.
So you couldn't ask them?
No.
So your grandfather was part of the 4th South Australian Contingent. Explain a little bit about that contingent.
230 men. It's the second biggest of these contingents going to South Africa. It's called the Imperial Bushmen. The term's a lovely, lovely term. Bushmen because they were supposedly Australian bushmen who could fight the Boers at their own game, good with horses and so on. Now, that's not necessarily the case. They were not as good riders as they like to think. Some of them were piano tuners. You had a couple of musicians. You had clerks in the public service. They were not all authentic bush types at all. The term imperial, as in an imperial bushman, came from the fact that the imperial government in London was financing the whole thing. So the troops were South Australian, raised in South Australia, but this was a unit in the British Army, not an Australian army, not a South Australian force technically. So paid for by the imperial government in London, they left. Now, from the moment the Premier, Mr. Holder, sent a telegram to London saying, you want us to raise a 4th contingent and you'll pay for it, the early contingents have been paid for in South Australia, but we were... Increasingly, the South Australian government is saying, no, 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 we're not going to do any more of that. With the imperial government saying that we want you to do another contingent, from the moment Premier Holder sent a telegram to London saying, yes, we will do that, to the day they sailed, Helen, it was 62 days. Now, 62 days, in that time they had to advertise to say, if you want to be considered, turn up at the old exhibition grounds to put your hand up and we will vet you and test you. Then the men who were selected had to be put through basic horse, and I mean basic, horse riding and medical tests. Then they were put into camp in the old exhibition grounds, which are, if you can imagine, you're down by the zoo, you're looking up Frome Road towards North Terrace, and on the left it's all covered by medical and university buildings. In those days it was a broad expanse of open tree with massive gums. And the old exhibition oval was there originally, and that's where they trained. Every South Australian unit trained there in the heart of the city. They were mounted infantry, so when their horses were issued to them, they would then ride out across the Albert Bridge by the zoo, and they would practice squadron drills below Montefiore Hill. So you can imagine the people of North Adelaide turned out regularly to watch these troops training right in the heart of the city. So it's a remarkable story. But they only had 62 days before they sailed, and in that time all you can do is, in that time you had to select them, give them some basic rudimentary training, enough that they could learn on the job once they're actually there. Nothing more than that. You had to produce all their equipment here in Adelaide. The best saddlery in South Africa, by common agreement, was manufactured by Holden and Frost. Now Holden went on to make certain other things, didn't they? But they made saddlery, and there was another firm down Curry Street. So the saddlery was the best in South Africa, and it was made here in Curry Street and Grenfell Street. And all of this had to be done, and then they sailed 62 days afterwards. Now, they sailed, they were raw, absolutely raw. And no wonder on their first day in action, three men were captured by the Boers. They were equipped by the British Army to British Army standards, which meant, as one Tasmanian officer said, we went into battle with so many pots and pans hanging off our saddles. He said, I couldn't have fallen off my horse if I'd tried. Whereas the Boers thought this was hilarious. The Boers rode into battle with a few strips of biltong, a lightweight saddle, you know, their Bible in their left hand and their Mauser rifle in their right hand, and they were incredibly lightweight. over a period of time, the Australians just discarded a lot of the junk that they'd been saddled with by the British Army. Buglers discarded their bugles. What's the point of a bugle out on the veldt? There wasn't much point at all. So they learnt fast, as indeed they had to, and they became very good at their game.
Wow, what a story. Do you know very much of your grandfather's service over there?
I do. I've managed to, through the wonder of Trove, and you know, I think for any historian like me, Trove's my best friend. I know virtually what he was doing on every day he was in South Africa. Now, he was, that's not as difficult as it sounds, because he was only in South Africa for 65 days. In that time, he won a Distinguished Service Order. He shot dead a Russian volunteer fighting for the Boers. I know where that happened and when it happened.
Can you expand on that?
Well, a lot of Britain was not the flavour of the month. Everybody hated Britain. The French, the Germans, the Irish, of course, the Russians. And so a lot of people from these other countries volunteered to fight for the Boers. Now, the Boers didn't necessarily want them and thought they were often a nuisance. But nonetheless, you didn't knock back help. And it was on the 26th of June near a small town called Lindley out on the High Veldt. And Lindley's a bit like Borough. My grandfather was leading the advance guard of a party of South Australians. And on the next ridge, about 1,100 yards away, so we're looking at a kilometre here, they see a small party of Boers looking at them. There's no fighting going on. The Boers are collecting information. A big attack will come the next day. And my grandfather says to Trooper Percy Richardson, and I know this from Percy's diary, which I have, he says to Percy Richardson, "Percy, hand me a rifle," and he fires one shot at the Boer commander on the next ridge over this kilometre distance, and the Boer falls from the horse, and he's dead when they ride up to greet him. He's a big, hulking man. And the ironic thing is my grandfather's 31, this man is 30, and they meet over the sights of a rifle. They never know each other, and yet I think they must have had a lot in common. Boris von Strohmann was his name. I found that out by accident years later in the Pretoria Cemetery in something which still quite amazes me. And in February last year, when I was in South Africa, I laid a wreath on his grave with the Russian ambassador, which was a deeply moving moment for both of us.
Right. How did you discover his grave?
Well, it was in October 2012. I was in Heroes Acre Cemetery in Pretoria with a bunch of other Australian military historians, and we were arguing, as we always do, over the grave of Breaker Morant. Now, Morant is buried in Heroes Acre for some reason, because he was shot, he was executed in Pretoria. And after we'd looked at his grave, we all started wandering off in different directions, and I'd said to Major Paul Nash, our South African military guide, "Paul, my grandfather on the 26th of June, 1900, near Lindley, shot dead a Russian naval officer. Didn't know the man's name." And Paul said to me, "That's the most amazing story. Pity we'll never know anything more about it." Well, half an hour later, we did know more about it, because he yelled at me from across the cemetery. I trudged over to where he was, and he's pointing at the grave of a Lieutenant Boris von Strohmann, killed in action near Lindley, 26th of June, 1900. And originally buried on the farm where he died, but 5 years later reinterred at the request of his mother in Moscow. And through various other sources, well, we now had a name. Within a few weeks, I had a photograph of him. And within a few weeks after that, I had a whole file of correspondence relating to his reinterment. So I feel as if I know this man quite well too. Any Russian naval warship in South African waters where the captain visits Pretoria for political reasons, Boris Strohmann is the only Russian naval officer buried in South Africa, and they always make a visit to his grave. And I'm very grateful that I've been able to tell the Russians and the ambassador personally on the spot last year precisely how Boris Strohmann died, because they didn't know.
Wow. That must be fabulous closure for the descendants of Boris.
Well, if they know about it, and I've really asked the Russian embassy if this news has been passed on to the descendants of the Strohmann family, but I have no idea if this has in fact happened, and certainly if I were ever in Moscow, well, I don't know how I'd knock on the door and introduce myself, but it's something I'd really like to do.
Hmm. What happened to your grandfather's life over there after that day that he shot Boris?
Well, he shoots Boris in June 1900, 3 weeks later. Not 3 weeks later, 1 week later, he's involved in what becomes quite a famous action. two batteries of guns, a British battery of six guns and a Boer battery, are hammering away at each other on an isolated farm from parallel ridges. The British battery commander tells his Australian troops who are taking hits to retreat behind the ridge where they will be less exposed to artillery fire. A Boer commando, and a commando is a group of men, by the way, not one man. A commando could be 50 men, it could be 500 or sometimes 2,000 men. Very flexible. It's a unit of military structure in the Boer fighting force. But a commando of about 100 men under Michael Prinsloo crept up through a valley. This is 5,000 feet above sea level, so there were virtually no trees there then, and the British battery commander thought that he could safely say to his men, retreat to the reverse slope where you're out of sight, you're going to be less exposed to plunging artillery fire and take less casualties. But of course, the protecting screen of dismounted infantry led by my grandfather couldn't see anything from the reverse slope because there's a mountain between you and the enemy. Anyway, the three of the six British guns are captured very quickly. And one British officer gets away, finds a pony, rides down the reverse slope, finds my grandfather and a number of his men. They charge up the hill and fire a volley and run screaming at the Boers. And the Boers, who haven't been able to bring up horses to cart the captured artillery pieces away, they flee. It makes sense from the Boers' point of view. The Boers are heavily outnumbered in all these engagements. There's no point in dying heroic and stupid deaths from their point of view. So my grandfather eventually is awarded a Distinguished Service Order for that. And 3 weeks later, he is badly wounded. He's shot through the cap. The bullet creases his skull but doesn't actually enter it. 5 minutes after that, he's shot in the heel of his boot, but again it misses him. And an hour after that, his horse is shot dead from under him. I have a vested interest in all this because my mother was born 7 years later. And interestingly, that particular incident where he and his men were holed up in a mud hut, in another mud hut, literally 50 metres away, was a young New South Wales doctor, Lieutenant Dr. Neville Howes. And this is the 24th of July 1900, and Dr. Neville Howes is winning the first Australian Victoria Cross in this other mud hut, 70 metres, 50 metres from where my grandfather was. I've been there with the farmer who was shot dead by, or who was murdered just a few weeks ago, actually, in one of these farm raids which are destroying South Africa now. So there we are.
There we are. What did the South Australians think of South Africa? I mean, the people, the landscape, the climate, the Boer enemy, very similar to Australian rural people.
They were, in many ways. About the landscape, everything was a bit back to front. I mean, it was hot and when it was hot in Australia, but on the other hand, in summer it doesn't rain. In summer it does rain there, but not here. In winter, it doesn't rain. And so everything was reversed in some ways. The grass for the horses was appalling, so most of our horses were dead within a few months of being there. It was very wiry, the nutritional values were very poor, Australian horses were too big. Not one horse came back from the war. As for the Boers themselves, the Australians were, well, you know, contemptuous, I have to say, in many ways, because bear in mind that the Boers fought a defensive war. It was not in their interest to attack. They were massively outnumbered. Why would you want to attack? But if you're lying flat on your stomach behind a ridge line with a modern Mauser magazine rifle which can kill you at 3,000 metres and you don't have to stand up and expose yourself to reload the way you did with a musket at Waterloo 85 years earlier, you can lie flat on your stomach. Smokeless powder has been invented just a few years before, and with smokeless powder you're virtually invisible behind this ridge. They cannot see you. And so effectively, the Boers always waited for the war to come to them. A lot of the Australians in their letters write home saying, oh, the Boers are cowards. As soon as we attempt to come towards them, they're over the back of the hill and their horses are waiting down the back of the hill on the reverse slope and their horses are fresh and they're away. And then you've got to repeat the whole exercise on the next hill. And there are lots of hills in South Africa. So the Australians were wrong to call them cowards. It just made just a very sensible, practical way of fighting for the Boers because it made sense. With modern weaponry, this modern magazine-loading rifle with a huge killing zone of several kilometres had changed the nature of warfare, and warfare for a time now favoured the defender. And, of course, there are machine guns as well, too, which are being introduced in the Boer War, so it's complicated. The landscape, then, black people, the Australians' attitudes were really mixed about this. Now, when they arrived on the wharf at the wharf at Port Elizabeth and their ship docks there, they had great fun with a sort of casual, flippant racism which marked the time. They'd throw halfpennies overboard and watch the black people on the wharf scrabbling for them. They thought that was great fun. But on the other hand, when they saw the Boers maltreating blacks, then a sort of righteous anger would sometimes take over. And one Australian writes home saying, the blacks who unloaded their troop ship at Port Elizabeth worked so efficiently and so fast, he said, that the wharfies of Port Adelaide could have taken an enormous lesson from these fellows. So their attitudes are really very mixed. It's not all out-and-out racism. I mean, I've no doubt that factor was there. The terms that they use are used that, you know, you don't use in polite circles these days, but their letters are littered with these terms. But that's just the way they were. So you can't change that.
Thank goodness they didn't have the internet in those days, because otherwise we'd have none of that memory. How many casualties did Australia suffer during the Boer War?
Well, we'll never really know, but it seems that around 23,000 Australians served. About 15,000 served in official units, and by that, Helen, I mean units raised by the South Australian or New South Wales governments, or after Federation, which happens in the middle of the war, by the new Australian Commonwealth government. So 16,000 serve in these official units. But the best view now is that in addition to for every two men who served in those official units, probably another one served in South Africa, made his own way to South Africa. Either they're already there mining for gold and thinks I'll enlist in a South African unit there. So we're never really going to know. We know that about 600 died in official units, so you'd have to assume that maybe another 300 die on top of that. So my guess is you're probably looking at 900. And in terms of fatalities, this makes it easily Australia's third worst war. It's a long way behind World War II and World War I, clearly. But a lot more dead than in Vietnam.
Hmm. Were there benefits awaiting them in Australia when they returned?
No, not really. The early South Australian units had some insurance policies taken out on them by the South Australian government for the first 6 months. And it depended on how you died. If you died from enteric fever or typhoid, you got less money, or your wife got less money, than if you were shot dead by the Boers. So you're equally dead, so it seems a bit bizarre. If you were a private, you got less money than if you were a captain. But there was something, and some men received, for example, Percy Richardson, who I mentioned, he received 3 shillings a day for the rest of his life because he was badly shot up at Lou Kop in July 1900, but always lived a pretty difficult existence as a farmer afterwards.
Hmm. The Boer War is sometimes called Australia's Forgotten War. Why is that?
I think the main reason for that is that it's our first war, literally. It's our first major war, but it's a forgotten war because 15 years after it ends, or 14 years after it ends, the World War I breaks out. And you have, say, 23,000 Australians serving in the Boer War, but you have 360,000 serving in the Great War, 1914-18. So 23,000 versus 360,000. And, of course, a lot of the service records of some of these Boer War men were destroyed after the war because the Boer War seemed a piddling little affair, if you like, compared with the First War, and there wasn't room to store records. So the records of very few South Australian servicemen, only the 5th contingent have survived, and there's just not much around.
Seems such a shame.
Well, but we're very fortunate, though, Helen, that they were fabulous letter writers, these men. They wrote letters home, and Mum and Dad would then go into the editor of the local newspaper, you know, the Southern Argus at Strathalbyn, or the Millicent Times, and say, look, you know, Percy, my son, has just written this letter back. Do you want to publish it? And inevitably they did, and they published them in full. So through Trove, the National Library's digital website now, historians have access to this incredibly large source of information in the form of letters that these wrote home. Now, sometimes you've got to divide by two. There might be a bit of bravado in the letter. But usually you can cross-correlate with other letters on the same subject and you can get very close to the truth. So there is, in fact, a vast amount of source material now there and accessible for historians, but accessible only in a way that wasn't possible 10 years before.
Well, thank goodness for Trove and the volunteers who transcribe that material.
Mm. Yes.
Tony, we have a beautiful Boer War Memorial here in Adelaide. Can you tell us about that? And also, do we have a national Boer War Memorial?
We have a superb war memorial here, and I'd love to tell you the story of it. That memorial, the idea came up for it within about 18 months before the war ended. Someone said, look, we're losing dead. This is our first war. We need a war memorial. You and I call it the Boer War Memorial, but until the late 1920s, it was called the National War Memorial, and that tells you something about how important this war was to South Australians. They felt strongly, and this was the cultural cringe of the time, that an Australian sculptor wouldn't be good enough. So inevitably, they went off to London looking for a sculptor, and they found one in Captain Adrian Jones. Captain Jones was a brilliant young man. He was very good with horses, and one thing the committee in Adelaide was quite sure about was that they wanted a centaur-like picture of the horse and the rider, because the Australians in South Africa were all mounted horsemen. And so if you look at that memorial on North Terrace outside the gates of Government House, it is superb, and it shows the horseman reining his horse in on the top of a hill. Captain Jones, the sculptor, was very good at that. The Agent General in London was asked to put together an ad hoc committee of any distinguished, well-known, famous South Australian who happened to be in London, and they waited on Captain Jones. And he said, look, I'm between major commissions for my studio at present. I just want to keep my workmen employed. Come back in a week and I'll give you some rough designs. And they came back in a week, and the rough designs he showed for them are what we have on North Terrace today. They fell in love with it straight away. They said, we've got our man, and he'll do it for only £1,600. And it's a fabulous story, but the story gets even better because the committee in Adelaide then said, but for the horseman on the horse, we want an authentic South Australian face on the horse. And it so happened that Quartermaster Sergeant George Goodall was in London at the time, and he received a telegram telling him to report to Captain Jones' studio, ostensibly just to advise Jones on details about saddlery and equipment that the trooper on the mounted horse would be carrying. But it's very, very clear when you look at Goodall's face and you look at the face of the actual carved on the man on the horse on North Terrace, it's the same man. Clearly, Captain Jones said to Goodall, sit down, I want your face. And this matters a great deal to the Goodall family today. I know the Goodall family, or several of them. When they drive past today, they salute Uncle George. He's their Uncle George on the statue. And the statue was the finest equestrian statue in Australia, probably, until the National War Memorial, the National Boer War Memorial, was unveiled in May last year, which is, for anyone going to Canberra, it's a must-see now. Unveiled in May, four mounted horsemen bursting out of the bush on Anzac Parade, and it's just a fabulous memorial.
Why do you think it took so long to obtain a national memorial?
Well, I think partly because this war seemed such a forgotten war, and it was so easily quickly overwhelmed by the memory of the two catastrophes of the two world wars. And let's be honest, the RSL initially wasn't terribly interested in it, and the RSL felt that the military tradition began at Gallipoli and Anzac Cove. Well, you can make out a really strong argument that it really began in 1900, 1901. As far as we know, about 30% of the men who landed at Anzac Cove on the 25th of April, 1915, about 30% of them seem to have been Boer War veterans. Most of Australia's generals in the First War served in South Africa, so they cut their teeth there. There's one distinguished name who didn't. His name was Monash, and he was a pretty useful general. But he felt no compulsion to go to South Africa. He just said, I understand some of my brother officers want to go there for military experience. I don't see any need. And so he didn't go.
Mm. Tony, you're the president of the South Australian Boer War Association. What does the association actually do?
We, a group of us, founded the association 5 years ago. And it's not just for descendants. It's for anybody who's interested in the war. We hold Descendants and Friends Day, at which we have short talks about the war. We have an educative role, but above all, we want to respect and honour the memory of the men and women. And I say women because about 9 nurses also served there in South Africa between 1899 and 1902. And we find interest is, in fact, increasing. So our membership is going up rather than down. So it's great. So effectively, we're a little ginger group to protect the Boer War interest, if I can look and put it like that. And we have a number of projects on the go at present.
And do you have a website?
We do indeed. South Australian Boer War Association will find us.
Tony Stimson, it has been an absolute delight talking with you and learning about the Boer War, aspects of the Boer War I'd never heard before. So thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Helen.